This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, May 7th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Eureka Springs and the May Festival of the Arts welcomes Michael Martin Murphy with opening performer Michael Jonathan, host of Woodsong's Old Time Radio Hour. This event is May 24th at the Auditorium. Jonathan will also host the premiere of the two episodes of Woodsong's Old Time Radio Hour that were taped in Eureka Springs last year on Friday evening, May 23rd. Tickets and more information available by calling 253-7333 or on the web, theaud.org.
The Rogers Historical Museum presents Family Day, May 17th, from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. This event celebrates Hog Wild, our area's love affair with the pig, and will include a piglet race, petting zoo, hog calling, and more. Located in historic downtown Rogers, this Family Day event is free and open to the public. 621-1154 or rogersarkansas.com/museum for more information.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Roby Brock leads a roundtable discussion to talk about the latest talk business and Hendricks College polls that look at how Arkansans may vote in the primary elections. Plus, Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families releases a new report on children's health coverage.
And in the latest installment of our monthly food series, the owner of Gunder Pickles makes us a jar of pickles using his great-grandmother's recipe. Also, a project looks at the idea of community. We hear an interview with gubernatorial candidate Mike Ross and more.
But first, President Barack Obama is scheduled to be in Arkansas today to see destruction caused by last week's tornado and meet with victims. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney discussed plans briefly during yesterday's daily press briefing.
The president already issued a disaster declaration, and he looks forward to meeting with victims, their family members, first responders, and local and state government officials in the wake of this storm and these tornadoes.
The president was invited to visit the state by U.S. Senator Mark Pryor.
A new poll out yesterday suggests Arkansas Republicans are overwhelmingly opposed to the private option, but the impact that it's expected to have on primary races is mixed. The survey, conducted by Talk Business and Hendricks College, polled more than 1,500 likely Republican voters. 54% of those polled oppose the private option, which uses federal Medicaid dollars to buy private insurance for low-income Arkansans. 23% favor the program enacted last year by the state legislature, while 24% say they don't know. Roby Brock explains that the private option has previously been a divisive issue among Republican candidates for the legislature.
Now we're seeing this play out in some of the campaign cycle here in these Republican primaries. What's interesting about our poll results are that just because Republican voters in general don't support the private option, it does not necessarily mean that they hold out against a candidate. When you look at some of the crosstabs.
Several high-profile Senate races put those who voted for the private option and its funding against opponents who are pledging to halt the program if elected. While some incumbents facing challengers are being impacted, Brock says others are not.
The 70th annual Rodeo of the Ozarks will be held in just less than 2 months at Springdale's Parsons Stadium. Plans to renovate the stadium moved forward last night after the city's planning commission approved the development plans, which will be considered by city aldermen later this month. Rick Culver is on the board of directors for the Rodeo of the Ozarks. He says the expansion plans would involve extensive renovations to Parsons Stadium.
We're going to have new bleachers and chutes will be on the west side. We're going to cover the whole arena. It won't be enclosed, but it'll be covered. We're also at the north end. We'll have a new office complex, which will have a museum, have our ticket office, have meeting rooms that we can rent out, and have a restaurant in our Buckle Club area. We'll be there where we serve the dinners for that. And then there'll be a new Buckle Club area. That'll be on the east side above the chutes when we get this all done. We'll have paved parking. It's just going to be a total upgrade.
The expansion project will also involve building a connection to the Razorback Greenway, which will eventually run along the west side of the rodeo grounds. All told, Culver says the project will probably cost roughly $17 million, and that a capital campaign will soon get underway. While he admits that it is a large amount of money to raise, Culver says when the project is complete, the stadium will be able to host a wider range of events.
Our goal is to have a multi-use facility where we don't have to worry about the weather. A lot of times we've got junior rodeos, and different events that have to do with, like, the FFA would like to come out and set up their judging for their state, different things. And we're always afraid to do that because of the rain. So if we got it covered, there's so many things that we get offered that we can't do now because the weather plays a part, and it scares people from putting on some events that they'd like to put on for the community.
He says once money is raised for the renovations, the project would likely take about 3 years to complete.
After less than 1 year at the helm of Downtown Bentonville Incorporated, David Deggs is resigning. He took the position of executive director last year, but effective June 1st, he will leave to take the position of director of adult and community education in the Fayetteville Public School System. According to the City Wire, the Downtown Bentonville board is seeking a new executive director, but in the meantime, Lisa Beebe, the organization's business operations manager, will serve as the primary contact for administrative issues and will provide continuity during the leadership transition.
A University of Arkansas researcher has received National Science Foundation funding to investigate the evolution of diatoms, single-celled algae found in many bodies of water. Andrew Alverson, an assistant professor of biological sciences and a plant biologist, received nearly $440,000 in grant funding to study the organisms. According to Alverson, there are an estimated 200,000 species of diatoms in the planet. And with the grant funding, he will examine genomic factors that will provide insight into the organism's diversity.
Back-in parking will stay on Block Avenue in downtown Fayetteville. Aldermen last night voted 5-3 to reaffirm the parking model, with Alderman Tenants, Schottmeyer, and Long voting to change the spaces to pull-in parking.
There was no change in tide for the Northwest Arkansas Naturals last night. The Nats lost the fourth and final game in the home series against the Travelers, with a final score of 5-4. The Naturals are now 11-21 on the season. The team remains home to open a four-game series tomorrow against Springfield.
Tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with a 20% chance of overnight showers and thunderstorms with lows in the mid-60s. Tomorrow, there's an 80% chance of showers and thunderstorms and expect highs around 77 degrees. Tomorrow night, expect an 80% chance of showers and potential thunderstorms in northwest Arkansas, and there's a 70% chance of showers in the Arkansas River Valley with lows in the lower 60s. This is Ozarks at Large. The latest round of Talk Business Hendrix College polling looks at how Arkansans may vote in the primary elections. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas recently sat down to discuss the upcoming elections with KATV's lead Capitol reporter Janelle Lilly. Robert Kuhn, a Republican strategist with Impact Management Group, and Skip Rutherford, dean of the Clinton School of Public Service.
Before we talk about those poll numbers, I think there's something else that's been more major that happened on Saturday.
Yeah, absolutely. Yesterday, we got the announcement that the president, President Barack Obama, is coming here to Arkansas to tour the damage on Wednesday with the governor. And I just want to ask the first question as far as how this plays politically. Of course, there's not a primary in the race where Senator Pryor is, but does it make any kind of difference?
I think it shouldn't. I hope it doesn't. We live in a very partisan environment, hyper-political. I think there are certainly some times when politics have to be put aside. I think the tragedy and damage, that we've seen with the tornadoes is one of those times. And I would hope that, the temptation to be snarky and jump into the partisanship would be resisted by folks.
I agree with that. We've seen disasters in the past. We've seen Oklahoma, Arizona, presidents come to support the victims, to support the families, to support the state. This rises above partisanship, and I agree with Robert. It doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat. When it comes to helping people who are struggling and who are hurting, it's the right thing to do.
You have two people who are not running for election, President Obama and then also Governor Mike Beebe. Mm-hmm. So both of those guys are the main headliners there.
And my question, too, though, is for Senator Pryor, who extended this invitation to President Obama to come here, does it blunt the stigma for him of the attachment to President Obama that is clearly a very big political factor in this year's races? if you're going to be seen with President Obama in a time of need, does that not help politically?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think, again, if you look at it from a political perspective, I think his request for President Obama coming is genuine. I mean, Arkansas needs help. Faulkner County was devastated, and so were many other little towns along the way. So I think you've got to look at this purely as I'm standing up for my state. I'm advocating for people. I think anybody in a responsible position would do that, Democrat or Republican.
I would agree with that. You know, I think having the president, regardless of what party he's in and who he is and whether or not he's well-liked, I think having the president here in this type of situation is one that's a good thing, and I would hope that it doesn't turn into a political issue.
Well, I'll take the position of that I do think it will turn into something of a political issue, and I do think that it will help Mark Pryor to be seen with the president in a time of need. I see that as being something that is very possible in terms of voter appreciation for that necessarily, particularly in a part of the state where Faulkner County leans very Republican.
Well, it might, but I mean, you know, again, you're going to have people, unlike Robert and me, who are so partisan on either side, that you're going to have people shooting at them. And I think it's a fair point to say that they're going to be critics. But I also think it's a fair point to point out that, look, it puts Tom Cotton in a little awkward spot. I mean, he voted against aid for Super Sandy. So the question is he going to support aid for Faulkner County?
Well, I can't see him not supporting.
I can't imagine any circumstance that he wouldn't do that.
Well, you know, that could be a flip-flop position.
Let's turn our attention to the 2nd Congressional District.
Yeah, these numbers were, I was very surprised when we got those. And 59% for French Hill, 14% for Colonel Conrad Reynolds, and then 7% for Ann Clemmer, which also surprised me considering how many voters you have in Saline County. What are your thoughts on this?
If these numbers are anywhere close, barring a major upset, French Hill is in a prime position to win this thing without a runoff.
I actually wanted to move you to the 4th District. We talked about the 20% undecided in the 2nd District, but you did some strong polling in Garland County in the 4th District and still getting 43% undecided. How does that play into the race?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, our poll construction was we surveyed Republican voters who they had to have a history originally of voting in previous Republican primaries. Then we asked them, did they plan to participate in this upcoming May 20th Republican primary? So I feel like it's a very strong likely voter in a Republican primary for those numbers there. The undecideds don't really surprise me. The 4th district's so vast. I mean, it's so big anyway. And we did get about a quarter of the votes out of Garland County, which you tell me. I mean, I think that's a pretty accurate representation of the 4th.
Yeah, I mean, the 4th district obviously has changed in recent years. I think still Garland County is a pretty substantial base there, and I would imagine it's going to turn out a significant amount of voters. And obviously that's, you know, Bruce Westerman's home, and right. and I know Tommy has some roots there as well, but
Bruce has been there for a lot longer and been elected to office there as well too.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's talk about the AG's race too. Would like to get y'all's take on that again. In this Republican primary, we see David Sterling with about 21%, Patricia Nation and Leslie Rutledge at 10 and 9. Huge undecided here. This stuff's going to have to break in the next 2 weeks. I mean, what's going to happen?
I was surprised at how many undecided there were. And, you know, maybe that will change now that Leslie just released that ad this past week. So I don't know.
Sterling's going up with an ad as well, too.
I saw his ad as well. Yeah, I haven't seen anything from Nation yet. Mm-hmm. But those numbers are certainly in flux, but 60% undecided.
So how does a voter make their mind up now that they're going to the poll on a race that I think the Attorney General's office is a pretty important one? You need to have some knowledge of what's going on there.
Go ahead.
I don't know. I mean, I think if you look at these numbers and you see, you know, again, if you were each of the campaign, what you'd be saying is, let's get on television. Let's get our name out there. Let's do this. But Robert makes a point about, you know, a targeted number of Republican voters. So, you know, maybe a strong direct mail campaign, a strong internet campaign. I don't know. I don't think the Republican voters even know their candidates for Attorney General. I think they know Bruce Westerman. They know Tim Griffin. They know Asa Hutchinson. I mean, but I don't think they know David Sterling or Leslie Rutledge.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think you've got candidates in this race that obviously have legal careers or have worked in party, but they haven't served the public. So they really are coming from an area of really low name ID. You know, as to how people make up their mind, There's a lot of different ways people make up their mind. It might be ballot position in some places. They might skip it all together and just not pick. I think it's probably pretty likely this one goes to a runoff if, you know, you don't see any major movement soon. You know, I would think just based on infrastructure and what I, you know, what I've seen some of the candidates doing, you probably are going to have Sterling and Leslie Rutledge in maybe a runoff and then see how it goes from there. You know, barring any kind of last minute major endorsements that help an undecided voter who doesn't know any of the candidates, that'll finally say, you know, well, if he likes her or he likes him, then I'll go with that. You know, that could be a last minute factor.
I agree with that. Leslie is from my hometown of Batesville. So our families have been friends for years.
And you're still not voting in the Republican primary.
But she is a very bright, talented woman. I mean, yeah, I may disagree with her politically, but I am certainly not criticizing her ability to be smart and her ability to make decisions. So I wouldn't underestimate her. I wouldn't underestimate her, though I do think that Sterling's ads about you know, his conservative positions and all that are getting out there
that
a little bit.
The PAC money paid for the,
well,
the senior
ground. Well, I think
ground.
That's right. And I think also, again, I think being from Central Arkansas, where he is known in the legal community, and what's the number of undecided? 60?
60.
Still at 60. It's pretty big.
You ought to get in the race, Robbie.
It's too late now. I'd have to go right in.
Go right in. Yeah. Robert and I could help you.
I don't think I could do that. So change my name to Elvis Presley. I might have
Colonel,
a little bit bigger.
You know,
Colonel
get that law degree,
CCR.
Too.
Right. Yeah, I do.
Well, CCR.
Do you have to have a law degree to run for attorney general? Or do you just have to be learned in the law? I think you just have to be learned in the law.
You probably have to have paid your dues, though.
Well, you definitely have to have your legal license.
Why would you have to do that?
That was Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business Arkansas, speaking with KATV's lead capital reporter, Janelle Lilly. Robert Kuhn, a Republican strategist with Impact Management Group, and Skip Rutherford, dean of the Clinton School of Public Service. You can find more from this conversation at talkbusiness.net. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T. Challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com.
Family recipes are often passed down from generation to generation. In the Gunderson family, the secret family recipe is one for pickles.
My entire life, I've kind of just been making pickles with my dad. Just not ever thinking anything, you know, of it. And, you know, when I'd bring friends over, and my dad would ask them if they like pickles, and they'd say, of course. And he'd open a jar and say, try these. And they'd be like, man, these are the best pickles I've ever had in my life. And I'm just like, whatever, they're pickles. They're pickles. So one Thanksgiving, about 2 years ago, something like that, I made a jar for my neighbors, and next thing I knew, I had to make two cases, and it's just kind of taken off from there.
We'll learn more about Gunder Pickles in the second half of Ozarks at Large.
Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families is closely tracking the rollout of the Affordable Care Act in Arkansas, in both the marketplace and under the private option. Last week, AACF held a press conference in Little Rock to release some very good news. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich brings us this story.
Anna Strong is Director of Health Policy at Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families.
25,000 children in Arkansas have gained coverage over the past 8 months, as their caregivers are getting coverage under the Affordable Care Act and the Arkansas private option.
Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families has been affecting policy reform at the state level since forming in 1977 in the realms of child protection, health, education, and economic security, and most notably, bringing to fruition Arkansas Kids First, Our Kids First, a health insurance program for poverty-level children.
in 1997 when Act 407 created the Our Kids First program, which expanded health coverage for Arkansas children up to 200% of the federal poverty level. And that, you know, at that point in time, there were about 22% of Arkansas children lacked health insurance. And starting the Our Kids First program, and then over time, Our Kids First became kind of the umbrella name for Medicaid and CHIP coverage, which is coverage for higher-income children.
And of 25,000 newly insured children, many were qualified for Our Kids First.
And then about 22,000 kids, a little more than 22,000 kids enrolled who were already eligible for Our Kids First. And then we also have about 2,500 children who enrolled in new plans through the marketplace in Arkansas. And those are the subsidized private insurance plans that children whose families earn more than the income cutoff for Our Kids First can apply for and enroll in.
Anna Strong's published her findings in a new report released last week by Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families titled Kids Health Coverage in 2014. The report reflects how the Affordable Care Act marketplace and Medicaid expansion in Arkansas, known as the private option, are affecting children's health care coverage.
So the private option is coverage for adults that are 19 to 64, and we know that prior to the passage of the Arkansas private option, Arkansas had some of the most restrictive eligibility for Medicaid in the country. It was very, very difficult for parents and other caregivers to access affordable health insurance if they didn't already have it through their job. Arkansas Medicaid did not cover childless adults, and for a parent to qualify for Medicaid coverage prior to the private option, a parent in a family of four would have to earn less than about $4,000 a year, which is 17% of the federal poverty level. And that's $4,000 a year. I'll just repeat that for emphasis. And that was the cutoff for parents to be able to access Medicaid coverage. So the private option has brought the reality and the promise of affordable health coverage to, you know, more than 150,000 Arkansas adults already. And the benefit that brings to children is kind of twofold. Number one, we are, as we stated in our press conference, seeing children get covered along with their parents. And that is a big win. Arkansas did an effort called SNAP Facilitated Enrollment, which is where they Arkansas DHS looked at their food assistance, their SNAP files, and they said, who is enrolled in SNAP that does not have health coverage through the state? And they sent out letters and said, you're eligible for the private option. And we know that about 65,000 adults enrolled that way, and about 3,000 kids enrolled along with their parents. So that was great. So that's kind of the first win. Kids are getting coverage along with their parents. Secondly, we also know that families are becoming more economically secure. And we know that one of the leading causes of bankruptcy is medical expenses. And about 62% of bankruptcies in Arkansas or in the United States involve some sort of medical debt. And so the more economic security we can bring to families, you know, we know that that's even better for kids. And so the private option is definitely a win for kids in several different ways when you look at the big picture. And we're excited to see so many adults getting coverage here in Arkansas as well.
In her report, Anna Strong says even though poverty levels continue to rise in Arkansas as a result of the Great Recession, the number of uninsured children has decreased.
Yes, and I think that just speaks to the fact that Our Kids First is there for families when they have a rough time. You know, if an adult loses a job during a recession, that we know that Our Kids First is there for children. And the great thing about Our Kids First is that it does cover working families, middle-income families. The new income level for a family of three is about $43,000. A family of three, their children can qualify for Our Kids First up to $42,746, which is, you know, a working family, yes, but a lot of times health insurance is so expensive that if families don't have access to that through work, then it's just unaffordable in the private market. But we know Our Kids First has been there through the recession as families' job situations may have changed.
But what about that 5.9% of Arkansas children who remain uninsured? Who are they, and why is that?
We know that Hispanic children and not the non-Hispanic other group, which does include Marshallese children and other Asian and Pacific Islanders, those children are much more likely to be uninsured than white or black children in Arkansas. And so there are those disparities, but we also know that immigrant children are much, much more likely to be uninsured than native citizens as well. More than 62% of foreign-born immigrant children are uninsured, which is in stark contrast to the citizen children as well. So the good news is that Arkansas has something that we can do. More than half of the states have already done this, and we can implement the Immigrant Child Health Improvement Act, or IKEA, as it's sometimes called, which allows Arkansas to cover children who are in the United States lawfully. But right now there is a 5-year bar for immigrant children before they can get coverage. You have to wait 5 years to get coverage, which is, in our opinion, too long to wait. And additionally, Marshallese children, because of their special status as a migrant family, they are not ever eligible, even after 5 years, for Our Kids First. But taking this option, which is a very simple administrative change the state could do, would allow several thousand Marshallese and legal immigrant children to get health coverage through Our Kids First.
And many uninsured children live right here in northwest Arkansas.
It is interesting. When we look at Benton County, for example, 8.2% of children in Benton County lack health insurance. And if we look at Washington County, we're at 8.1%. And that's when our state average is closer to 5.9%. So, we are seeing a part of the state that we normally think of as very prosperous, that still has high rates of uninsured children.
The cover of Anna Strong's report, Kids Health Coverage, in 2014 shows a little girl getting a shot, looking straight into the camera with a smile. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can read the Kids Health Coverage in 2014 report at aradvocates.org.
It is Wednesday, May 7th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And here with us now, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
We have neglected to take people around the area for some things coming up over the last few weeks.
Right. We haven't done any Arts Away in a while.
So away we go. Kansas City has a bunch of phenomenal music coming up.
Yes.
Phenomenal. May 31st, Cher at the Sprint Center. June 7th. Some people might think it's phenomenal, the Backstreet Boys at Starlight Theater.
I did when I was about, 12 maybe?
Yeah.
Kind of missed that whole thing. June 8th, Styx and Foreigner at Starlight Theater. July 16th, Paul McCartney at the Sprint Center. June 25th, Widespread Panic is at Starlight Theater. July 3rd, Sarah McLachlan is at Starlight. July 6th, Willie Nelson with Alison Krauss at Starlight. July 14th, Journey and the Steve Miller Band at Starlight. July 16th, Pat Benatar with Rick Springfield at Starlight. August 14th, Rod Stewart and Santana at the Sprint Center. And in Dallas, May 17th, the Dave Matthews Band at the Gexa Energy Pavilion. Also May 17th, Styx and Foreigner at the Verizon Theater at Grand Prairie. May 25th, Journey and the Steve Miller Band at the Gexa Energy Pavilion. And June 7th, George Strait, Alan Jackson, Kenny Chesney, and Faith Hill at AT&T Stadium in Arlington. Check out Events Away every week in What's Up, and we'll tell you more.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Back in April, Eric and Charlotte Kaufman were sailing to New Zealand with their 3-year-old and their 1-year-old, and they made international news when they got into trouble in the open seas. This week on This American Life, they give their first interview about what happened. Cracks in their hull and water leaking in and their satellite phone failing. They had 2 radios but couldn't tell if they were working or not. Their baby's sick, and they have to decide whether to abandon ship. Literally abandon ship. That's this week.
Listen Sunday at 10 a.m. to 91.3 FM.
The 5th annual Singing for Space picnic to benefit Spey, Arkansas will be May 17th from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Dog Party USA. Tickets will be available at the door. Barbecue with all of the fixings, refreshments, and live music will be offered. More information available at spayarkansas.org or on Facebook at Spey Arkansas. SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, presents its season finale concert May 10th at Walton Arts Center. Under the baton of Maestro Paul Haas, the concert will feature Mozart's Hofner Symphony and Mahler's Symphony No. 1 in D major. Tickets available at 443-5600 or sonamusic.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. According to Merriam-Webster, community is a group of people who live in the same area, or a group of people who have the same interests, like religion, race, or a unified group of individuals. Community differs greatly from person to person, from school to work, to home and family, or to a group of friends, a town, city, or country. A year-long project at Fayetteville High School explored the theory, concept, and idea of community. The project was part of the University of Arkansas's College of Education's Adopt a Classroom program. This program is funded by a grant from the Arkansas Department of Education, and places a U of A professor in an area classroom one day a month for an entire school year, with the aim of connecting students to college and what they learn to the real world. The program is designed to go into K-12 classrooms across 27 districts. This particular community program worked with juniors and seniors at FHS. It was led by Kevin Fitzpatrick, Jones Chair of Community and Family at the U of A.
It gives people like me an opportunity to see something that I don't ever get a chance to see, and that's inside a high school classroom. And newfound respect for secondary school teachers.
The project, entitled How Do You See Community, began last October when Fitzpatrick first stepped into five different sociology classes to teach them about issues related to community, specifically focusing on Northwest Arkansas and quality of life issues. The project concluded last week with an open house showcasing the students' work, photographs exhibiting what community looks like through each pair of eyes. Fitzpatrick says he communicated with the high schoolers a bit differently than he does his college students.
In terms of getting them to understand issues related to community and what that concept means, and how that concept looks differently to different people, because I think if you look at all these pictures, you see that there's 100 different lenses out there that are really capturing for us what our community looks like. And I don't think you can get that any other way.
He says he started this project with a sociological approach by introducing the way community is thought about. He then provided some important issues. He says there was a lot of conversation about the key components to community. Fitzpatrick says he spends more time just talking in front of a classroom at the college. Here, there was an open dialogue in which the students were allowed to formulate their own ideas.
We didn't tell them. We didn't want to in some way impact their view about community too much, because we knew we wanted to go out there, have them go out there and take pictures. So if we told them too much about what to think or how to see community, it would definitely color their perspective.
Fitzpatrick wanted the students to take their own pictures and not their teachers. High school photography teacher came into the sociology classes to give a brief tutorial on how to capture a good picture. Fitzpatrick says he was impressed with the quality of photos the students captured, many of which were done so with an iPhone or other smartphone camera. He doesn't believe that they would have taken these photographs in October based on what their ideas of community were then. They've evolved over time.
I look at these pictures, and to be able to get some of these pictures where they are now, I'm not sure that would have happened necessarily, a month into it.
Sookie Hires is the sociology teacher at FHS, and she's taken the sociology course far from its two-section textbook beginning to a five-section class that has become a very popular elective. Hires has previously worked with Fitzpatrick on the One Book, One Community project a couple of years ago. So letting him adopt her classroom was easy.
I enjoyed having him come in and talk to the kids, and it's nice for them to get to know that university professors aren't all ogres, that they're, human beings. They're right across the street. We need to form a better connection between these two education systems.
She says this community project fit perfectly into her survey of sociology curriculum that typically addresses the different organizations that make up a community. This project brought it all together as well as bringing the arts integration aspect into it through the photography. Heyer says, according to her students, community was a concept they hadn't consciously thought about until her course. But over time, they came to many realizations.
For one thing, that place matters and where they come from has an impact on who they are, which is a key idea of sociology. But by going out into our community and kind of looking at these ideas, have pulled together their own personal view of what community is. And I think a lot of them also realize that my view of community may be different from the person next to me. So just kind of understanding that we all have these varied viewpoints, these different perspectives.
Jenny Bryan is a senior sociology student who signed up for the course because a friend told her she had many similarities to Ms. Heyer's. Not knowing much about sociology when she began back in August, the course has turned into one of her favorites and something she now understands.
It is the study of people and like how people interact with each other and what's around you, and it's really made me pay more attention to people around me and like people watching and like observing what people do around each other, and it's gotten me into making people uncomfortable. And like we did this whole project where we had to break social norms and like do things in public that people don't normally do.
She says it was funny to realize that people act a certain way and to then mess that up and see their reactions. She says her vision of community has also changed throughout the year. She's even changed her own community, allowing her to come out of her shell a bit.
Like my community before this year was like in this tight-knit group of like two or three people, and like this year taking different classes and like talking to different people and becoming friends with more people, I have broaden my own community and like I guess gotten to know people that are different from me and like people from all over the place, and so my community is a lot bigger and not really what I would have perceived it to be 2 years ago. Like I wouldn't see myself being friends with these people and like doing all these different things, but now I'm here and I really like it and I don't want to leave.
With graduation next week, Jenny will be leaving, heading to the University of Georgia, where she will find a new community. We make our way through a crowd of students and parents to the wall where Jenny's picture hangs among the other photographs taken by students in her first period sociology class. Part of the assignment was to caption and title the picture.
I titled it Entwined, and I said this represents community because of the universality of the sky, and no matter where we are, everyone shares the same sky. And it's kind of cheesy, but when I took that picture, I was hammocking in the park with my friends, and it's just like a nice place to go, and it's like a bonding experience. And That's a place that I do go a lot, and that a lot of my friends go a lot, and a lot of different types of people go there, and I just find it to be very peaceful and like a place that is accessible to everyone.
The photo was taken from the position of lying in her hammock, and is of the branches and trees intertwining overhead in the evening twilight. Though she had tried to intentionally take photos for the project, this one happened inadvertently, natural being the way to go. The U of A took control of the processing and printing of the photographs for judging and display here this evening. Each student in each class had a chance to win a cash prize for first, second, or third place out of their respective classes. So there were 15 winners total. Judges were the FHS photography teacher, plus two professors and two graduate students in the sociology department at the U of A. Jenny didn't know until this evening that her picture had earned her third place in her class and $25. Kevin Fitzpatrick announced the winners in front of the group of students and parents last week.
How about third place Jenny Bryan? Jenny, you got it. Good job. Good job, Jenny.
This is Ozarks at Large.
Family recipes are often passed down from generation to generation. Maybe your grandmother taught you her mother's apple pie recipe. Or maybe your dad is well known for using his father's chili recipe during the holidays. Fayetteville native Garrett Gunderson is carrying on his great-grandmother's pickle recipe in the form of his business venture, Gunder Pickles.
My entire life I've kind of just been making pickles with my dad. It's not ever thinking anything, you know, of it. When I'd bring friends over, and my dad would ask them if they like pickles, and I'd say, of course, and he'd open a jar and say, try these. And they'd be like, man, these are the best pickles I've ever had in my life. And I was just like, eh, whatever, they're pickles. They're pickles. So one Thanksgiving, about 2 years ago, something like that, I made a jar for my neighbors. And next thing I knew, I had to make 2 cases, and it's just kind of taken off from there.
Garrett says his family dates the recipe at about 1903, but it could be a little older than that. At that time, he says his family was living in a small town in South Dakota called Mobridge.
Back then, you know, there weren't any refrigeration. There was no freezers. It was just cellars, and, you know, you'd bury things. And so this process was just a pickling, was a stone pickle, like a big stone crock, like those ones over here. Actually, you should probably see them like that. Like the Red Wing crocks you find in old antique stores, it was that process. So they would fill it up with fresh cucumbers and fresh dill out of the garden and a bunch of salt and whatever else they want to throw in there. And they'd stir it up and they'd put a wood lid on it. And they'd say, don't touch these for 5 days. And that was kind of how this pickling process is. It's the exact same thing, but I'm putting them in jars for people instead.
Garrett fills mason jars with his pickles. Having made them for most of his life, he makes the process look so easy. After unscrewing the lid, he places the empty mason jar on top of a silver metal tabletop.
First thing we'll do is we'll put all of our seasonings in. That way, when we're ready, we'll shake it all up and it'll kind of look like a snow globe of seasonings.
Glancing at the recipe, which is typed out on a white sheet of paper that looks like it's been folded and unfolded a couple of times, Garrett starts measuring different spices and adding them to the jar. Among other things, he mixes in white pickling salt, garlic, celery seed, red pepper, and fresh dill.
Now, the true difference between my pickles and any other pickles is this. Fresh dill. Because when you look at Claussen or Vlasic or any other company, they don't have this. And this, to me, I believe is what sells it or what makes it. People say it's the crunchiness. People say it's the flavor. I truly believe it's the dill. It's the big dill.
Now Garrett's ready to prepare the cucumbers. They're too tall for the jars, so Garrett cuts off a portion of the cucumbers so they can fit. These leftover pieces can be used to make pickle slices later. Given the choice between slices or spears, I choose spears. Garrett then sets a silver metal contraption on the table. 4 legs support the circular base of the machine, which contains metal spear shapes in the middle of it. A second circular plate slides up 2 poles to make room for a cucumber, which is placed on top of the base. The top plate is then used to push the cucumber over the protruding metal shapes at the bottom of the machine, slicing the cucumber into spears.
This is a spear. So basically my cucumbers will go in here. Seem to get it off. There it is. And I'll make spears like that.
After making spears out of 3 cucumbers, Garrett shoves as many of them as he can into the jar.
I just try to get it as full as possible. When you look at other, you know, jars of pickles, there's like a half inch of brine just floating on the bottom. It's like, well, that's just, to me, that's just a waste. I might be a little pricey on my prices, but it's the best quality you can get.
That price, by the way, is $10 for a quart-sized jar. After screwing the lid back onto the mason jar, Garrett offers one last bit of instruction.
Now my dad, he swears my great-grandmother told him, you make these in jars, you gotta flip it upside down, see how it's all cloudy and salty and all that, shake it. Where that goes away. And then he says, I don't know if this is true, and it probably is, I don't know. He says, when you put this in the refrigerator, every time you open that refrigerator, you turn it.
Upside down.
Every time. Every time you go in the fridge, he says, turn it upside down. And then turn it right side up. I don't know. I have no idea. I don't have time to do that with 12 cases of cucumbers, but he swears by it.
Garrett uses a black Sharpie to write a date on top of the lid. It's 7 days from now, and that's the day I can take the pickles out of the refrigerator and they'll be ready to eat. For now, Garrett sells his pickles at Mickey Finn's Irish Pub in Fayetteville, where he bartends. His pickles are also served at Cafe Rue Orleans and Apple Blossom Brewing Company. Garrett would like to grow his business and perhaps one day have a small storefront or even sell his pickles in stores, although he would likely stay away from a big chain store because he thinks mass producing his product might cause its quality to suffer. He says he's concerned with quality because there's so much junk out there.
I mean, growing up, you know, you just think a pickle is a pickle. You think a pickle is a Vlasic pickle or Mount Olive. And I'm not saying these companies are bad, but these companies are just mass producing pickles. And yeah, they're generic, but who wants generic when you can have something just fresh? When you open it, you can smell it. You can just taste it. When you grab a pickle and you put it in your mouth, for the next 30 minutes, your hand smells like pickles. You know, that's, to me, that's what a true pickle is. It's not something that has yellow water. You don't know what's in it. I'm not a fan of that.
Garrett says people seem to enjoy his family's pickles, so he plans to keep making them until they don't. He says his two favorite things about his business are seeing people smile when they eat his pickles, and then when people say they taste just like their grandmother's pickles.
It's just good. It's just good product. It's just fun. It's, I mean, how can you not have fun when you eat a pickle? I mean, you literally, it's a pickle. It's vinegary. It has flavor to it. It's beautiful.
Garrett will have his pickles for sale May 18th during the Block Street Block Party in Fayetteville. To find out more about ordering pickles or some of Garrett's other offerings, such as green beans, okra, or sauerkraut, visit facebook.com/GunderPickles.
Early voting for primary elections is underway. This week, Jacob Kaufman from our content partner KUAR in Little Rock is speaking with candidates for the governor's office. Yesterday, we heard from Lynette Bryant. Today's discussion is with Mike Ross of Prescott. Ross, a former congressman and lobbyist for Southwest Power Pool, faces Bryant in the Democratic primary for governor.
Arkansas's current tax structure has lower income residents paying a higher percentage of their income than wealthier residents. Can you detail your tax plan?
Yeah, you know, the state income tax code was written in 1971 when the median household income was $8,000 a year and gas was 36 cents a gallon. Today, the median household income, still too low, is $40,000 a year, and what gas today is about $3.50 a gallon. For 25 years, they did not index the income brackets that determine the income tax rate you pay for inflation. And so as a result, they're out of whack, and it needs to be fixed. We have six state income tax rates in Arkansas, and yet 60% of hardworking Arkansans are in the top two rates. One out of every three is in the top rate. In fact, the top rate starts at $34,000 a year, which means a single mom working two jobs trying to make ends meet is paying the same state income tax rate as someone making $340,000 a year or someone making $3.4 million a year. It's not fair, and I'm going to fix it.
And could you articulate your position on the private option, Arkansas's plan to use expanded eligibility and funds from the Affordable Care Act, originally intended for the federally run Medicaid program, but used to purchase private insurance for low-income residents?
I support the private option. I would have voted for it. I would have signed it. And as governor, I'm going to protect the funding for the Medicaid expansion, the so-called private option. And here's why. And for those people that are opposed to the Affordable Care Act, they need to understand that the only part of the Affordable Care Act that state governments have any control over is the Medicaid expansion piece. And what we did in Arkansas in a bipartisan manner with a Republican legislature and a Democratic governor is so far removed from the Affordable Care Act that they had to go to the federal government and get a waiver approved to be able to implement it. But the Affordable Care Act, in order to pay for the Affordable Care Act, cut reimbursements to hospitals. But they said the hospitals will be okay because they're going to start getting paid to treat people that they've been treating for free through this Medicaid expansion. So for states that aren't doing the Medicaid expansion, their hospitals are still receiving those significant cuts to hospitals, and in fact, a few rural hospitals in some of the states that have refused to do the Medicaid expansion have gone out of business. So it's the right thing to do for our rural hospitals. It's also the right thing and the compassionate thing to do because we already have nearly 150,000 working Arkansans who signed up for this. And, you know, I hear people say that, well, I don't want to provide health insurance to people who do not want to work. Well, guess what? They're already getting it. They already qualify for Medicaid. This Medicaid expansion addresses the people that are trying to do the right thing and stay off welfare, but they're working the jobs with no benefits. And then it saves the state about $89 million a year, and some people have trouble comprehending or understanding how that could be. Well, you know, as you drove to work today, you didn't see diseased, sick people laying in the ditch. I mean, we have state-run programs that provide uncompensated care for those that don't have insurance. Through the private option or the Medicaid expansion, we'll no longer need those uncompensated care programs. From a fiscal standpoint, it makes sense. From helping save our hospitals, it makes sense. And from a compassionate standpoint, it makes sense. And for the life of me, I don't understand why anybody would be against that.
Higher ed officials will tell you their budgets aren't keeping up with costs, and that goes down the line to pre-K. Tell us a little bit about education and your pre-K plan.
Well, surprisingly, less than half of the four-year-olds in Arkansas are enrolled in pre-K. Little Rock, for example, every four-year-old whose parents want them to go to pre-K has a seat in a pre-K classroom. Lake Hamilton School District, the 20th largest school district in Arkansas near Hot Springs, does not even have a pre-K program. Fayetteville. Only 5 of the 9 elementary schools have a pre-K program, and each of those has a pretty long waiting list to get in. To me, it's about more choices for parents. If a parent wants to send their 4-year-old to pre-K, there should not be a waiting list for them to get into pre-K. And so I've got a plan to address that. It's a major part of my positive vision for the future of the state, and here's why. We know if you go to pre-K, you're less likely to repeat a grade. You're more likely to graduate high school, you're more likely to go to college, graduate college, you're more likely as an adult to be employed when other people are not, and you're less likely to end up on government assistance, you're much less likely to end up in prison. From the time we're born through the third grade, we're learning to read, and from the fourth grade through the rest of our life, we're reading to learn. Studies tell us that when you hit the fourth grade, if you're still trying to learn to read while you're reading to learn, you fall behind. To fully implement the plan, which we cannot do overnight, because it's more than just money. And we could fully implement the plan. Every 4-year-old whose parents want them in a public pre-K or a private pre-K participating in the ABC program in Arkansas, which, by the way, is ranked 11th in America in terms of curriculum. They're doing an outstanding job. It's not the quality of the program is not at issue. The issue is having enough seats in the classrooms, which is why we can't do this overnight. We need more teachers, so it's going to have to be phased in a way that's responsible and that will work. To fully fund the program would take about $37 million under my proposal. The leading Republican candidate in this race, Asa Hutchinson, says we can't afford that. Then he says we can afford $100 million in tax cuts in year one. It's about priorities. And for me, I believe with our young people, we need to start sooner. We need to finish stronger. And if we do that, we can reduce the number of young people who need to be remediated when they get to college, which is costing the state $43 million a year.
That was Jacob Kaufman from our content partner KUAR in Little Rock, speaking with Mike Ross. He's one of two candidates seeking the Democratic nomination in the primary for Arkansas's gubernatorial race.
Support for KUAF comes from Westwood Gardens. Celebrating Mother's Day with hanging baskets, garden gifts, and blooming roses at four locations in Northwest Arkansas. 442-3500 or westwoodgardens.com for locations or more information.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Durham.
Durham. Mm-hmm. I believe tomorrow, Thursday, we'll welcome Kyle Kellums back.
I believe so. He'll be back from vacation.
Right, he will be. Also on tomorrow's show, I'll talk to Velda Brotherton. She's written a book about Ozark recipes and traditions related to food. She'll be at the Fayetteville Public Library on Saturday for a Flavor of the Ozarks event that's happening there all day long. So some interesting stories about eating possums and such that Velda will have tomorrow.
Looking forward to that. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Gray.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Christina will be back along with her co-host, Kyle Kellums. Have a fantastic Wednesday.